I'm Kevin Middleton.
And I'm Samantha Berg. And this is The Bridge to Everywhere. Welcome to The Bridge to Everywhere. Join us as we explore health, community, and culture from a holistic perspective. Health topics addressed on our show are for information and entertainment and should not be taken as medical advice. If you have a medical condition, please consult an appropriate care provider.
Hi, everyone. Thank you for joining us. Welcome to The Bridge to Everywhere. I'm Kevin Middleton. I'm here with Samantha Berg, and tonight our guest is John Hargrove. He's joining us for a part two. We spoke with him last week this time, and we covered a lot of material about his experience as a trainer at SeaWorld. He was a senior, probably one of the most experienced SeaWorld trainers in the industry, in the captive whale industry, and he left his position there in August 2012. He's joined a very small but growing unprecedented group of former SeaWorld trainers who've come out to publicly speak against captivity. He is featured in the upcoming film release Blackfish, which will be out in mid-July. It's a powerful film. It was selected at Sundance, and it is just blowing audiences away across the world on the film festival circuits. Now, tonight we want to get into some of the material we didn't have the time for, but we also had a lot of questions coming in, and we didn't have a chance to answer all of those. So we're going to start with that, and we also want to invite you to ask questions, and we'll try to get them answered on the air. And you can do that in one of two ways. One is by messaging us on Facebook, Bridge to Everywhere, and the other is emailing us directly at wow@BTERadioshow.com.
Ooh, I like that.
So wow@BTERadioshow.com. I just set that email account up earlier today.
I love that. Wow.
Figure you could remember that easily. So, yeah, that might be the best way to do it, just because sometimes Facebook is hard to navigate to get the questions. There's a few different areas where they come through. So welcome, John. And Sam, do you want to just add a few things?
Yeah, before we start talking, John, I just want to give everybody a recap on what we covered last time and just give you guys, again, another brief bio for anybody who didn't get a chance to listen to the show last Monday night. It is now archived on Radio Free Palmer site. So if you go to radiofreepalmer.org and you click on Bridge to Everywhere, you'll see that show. You'll be able to listen to it. You can also go to our Facebook page, Bridge to Everywhere, and you'll see a link for the past show. So if you want to listen to that after listening to this show, you can certainly go back to that. This show will rebroadcast on Wednesday at 5 p.m. Alaska time, and then it will also be posted. So introduction to John again. I just want to let you guys know, John Hargrove, again, he's 39 years old. He's got 14 years of experience as a killer whale trainer, and that includes experience both at SeaWorld of California and SeaWorld of Texas, where he's promoted to the highest ranking senior trainer. It's called a Senior One. Trainers at this level must be considered specialists in some area, his being water work and knowledge and application of behavior. This skill set and reputation earned John the privilege of working with and swimming with the corporation's most dangerous killer whales. John gained international killer whale experience as a supervisor with Marineland in the south of France. In France, he conditioned and performed water work with naive killer whales that had never swam with trainers before. He resigned his position with SeaWorld in August 2012 and currently resides in New York City. So welcome to the program, John. Great to have you back.
Hey, Kevin. Hey, Sam. Thank you for having me back. This is fun.
So before we get into the listener questions, we had a quick recap. What we talked about last time was your experience as a SeaWorld trainer, how one becomes a SeaWorld trainer, and then why you decided to leave the company. And we also got a little bit into some of the accidents that have occurred over the past few years with killer whales and trainers. Specifically, we talked about Don Brancho's death in 2010 and also Alexis Martinez's death in 2009. And before we get into the questions, two topics we really want to get into tonight are the recent OSHA citation that just came up today. OSHA recited SeaWorld for safety violations, so we want to talk about that. And we also want to get into the topic of captive breeding at SeaWorld. SeaWorld now breeds orcas in captivity, and we want to talk a little bit about the ethical issues and how captive breeding actually works. And so we want to definitely get into that. But before we even do that, we just wanted to ask you if there's anything from last time that you felt that you wanted to cover that we didn't bring up, and then we'll go into some questions from our audience.
No, not right now. I mean, I was really happy with the amount of stuff that we were able to cover last week and the things we did get into. And I know that, you know, tonight we're going to get into some things that are equally as deep and important. So I'm looking forward to it.
Okay, so let's go ahead and start with questions.
You know, and before we do that, I just want to point out, for those that don't know, Samantha is herself a former SeaWorld trainer, and she left, was it 92, 93, is that right?
Yeah, left in August of 93.
Yeah, and she's also one of the trainers who are featured in the movie Blackfish, and she's got an incredible depth of experience and working together with the other former trainers and researchers, scientists, activists, and journalists in this unfolding movement, basically, that's happening in the past few years.
So I want to read a comment from one of our readers just to start out with. This is in response to the last show that we did. And the comment's from Fran Tatu, and her comment is, listening to this incisive, enlightening interview, one of the heart-wrenching facts is despite how many hundreds of millions of profit the whales have made for SeaWorld, nothing has been done to improve their tanks in decades. It's well past time SeaWorld be shut down and be held accountable. So that's pretty strong language, actually. I know that we've talked about this issue before. How do you feel about that? What do you think SeaWorld really should do here in the future? What do you think is a potential direction for SeaWorld to go at this point?
And should they be shut down? Is that the reasonable direction?
For me personally, I don't think that that's realistic because of how much money they have, how much power they have. I think that what is realistic is for SeaWorld to drastically alter their business model. I get this question a lot now, and I'm sure you do too, Sam. Especially since this film premiered at Sundance back in January. You know, what do we think or what do we expect or want SeaWorld to do at this point? SeaWorld has an amazing opportunity right in front of them. You know, and Sam, you and I have talked about this a lot between the two of us. But you know, here there's all this criticism, which I think is just and deserving. And all of these things that they have done in the past and now they're finally having to answer for, they have an incredible opportunity to repair their image. Instead of continuing to go down a downward spiral, they could be open and receptive to the scientific community. They could have some type of symposium where you invite not only the other side, so to speak, the scientific community to come and give their input, but also even just a meeting of the minds with people out in the public, people who are passionate about these animals, who want a better life for them. And just, you know, SeaWorld could come out and say, okay, we're ready for the next step. We have heard you. We hear people out there saying that they're ready for a change. Let's take that step together for change. What do people think is the next step? And obviously, you're not going to be able to meet every single person's demand, but the compromise of it, you know, and just simply being willing to come to the table and including the scientific community, including the brilliant minds that are out there that could come up with some phenomenal ideas, and having some type of compromise, they could greatly repair their image and continue to evolve for the animals that are still in captivity. Because I personally believe that this needs to be a thing of the past for entertainment purposes. Obviously, we're not going to get there if we don't stop the breeding program, and I know we're going to get into that tonight. But what do you do about the killer whales that are still in captivity? Some people may feel like, no, we need to set them free. We need to be responsible with that decision, and I feel like the ones that are still in captivity, we need to give them dignity, and we need to be responsible about that decision, but absolutely stop the breeding program so this just doesn't, you know, continue forever.
I think that's awesome, and I also think they can do a really good job being an educational facility. I think it's kind of ironic that part of the requirement of the Marine Mammal Protection Act is in order for SeaWorld to have these animals on display, and they're actually displaying them on behalf of the public. Technically, they're taking care of them, that we own, technically the public owns them, and SeaWorld is maintaining them on display and making money off of them on behalf of the public, but they're required to have some sort of educational component to the shows. So I think that the pressure that's coming at SeaWorld right now, I mean, I would love to see them change these shows to be something really educational so people really come out and learn what is going on with our oceans right now. What can people really do to make a difference? You know, what are the major issues going on right now? Because, honestly, the oceans are dying. So, you know, SeaWorld could be getting that information out to people. And I also feel like that the fact that these facilities are in existence and as we're starting to phase out the potentially the killer whales, trial shows that they're going to have these facilities that can be used for rehabilitation. And so, you know, I think of all the knowledge that the SeaWorld veterinarians have gained over the years of having animals in captivity. Think about what could be done towards having these facilities used for rehabilitation when there are accidents or when there are strandings. So there's some really good things that SeaWorld could do. So I completely agree with you that, I mean, I would love to see them change their business model and they could use their powers for good, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, Sam, you know, their motto is conservation through education. I challenge anyone out there to go to any one of the Shamu shows at any of the three parks and come back to me and tell me what educational content they got out of that show. There is no education content in those shows anymore. And what's sad is there used to be. When, you know, the shows that I did in the 90s and the early 2000s at SeaWorld were more educational than, I'd say more, there was an educational content to it, component to it, and there is no education at all in the shows that we do today. And so how is it that they've gone backwards instead of evolving, you know, and going forward? It's like the wrong people are in the wrong positions that they're making this decision of let's take out all the education and let's just make it entirely entertainment-driven. And, you know, what do you think, Sam? I mean, the shows that you did at Shamu in Florida in the early 90s compared to the shows today, the One Ocean show or even the show before, the Believe, don't you remember there being an educational part of the show even back then?
There was some more educational component to the show, for sure. It seems like the direction that the shows have moved are more about flashy visuals and having, you know, particular music cues and trainers dancing. I mean, we had a dance back in the 90s, for sure, but some of the footage that I've seen from YouTube videos is quite frankly, it's kind of embarrassing that, you know, it's more about, it's kind of like putting on a Broadway show more than it is giving people some real education and understanding of the marine life and about the killer whale's natural history and what their real behaviors are like in the wild.
You know, I want to bring Doreen DuPont in on the conversation. She's commenting on Facebook, and she says, they are in the business to make money. They're not a nonprofit organization. The money's in the breeding program. Shut them down. And so she still, you know, feels very strongly about that. And I think that that's, you know, a lot of people feel that way. Obviously, you're pointing out to the practical reality is shutting them down may not be the in the best interest short term for the whales, obviously. But then the longer term picture, it does seem like there's incredible opportunity for education to emphasize the rehabilitation dimension. But, you know, I wanted to ask you about that, John. With rehab, are there any whales that come in that ever go back out? Is that, do you know, when there's a stranding or there's whales that have been brought in, have you ever seen or you know, anything close to that where whales...
Killer whales?
Yeah, you're talking about killer whales or beluga whales or Sudorca whales or Sudorca dolphins or...
You know, that may have happened with Sudorcas. I kind of feel like that has happened, but to be perfectly honest with you, that's not my area of expertise. I can't tell you with killer whales that does not happen. So I have never in my career have I heard of a stranding of a killer whale where SeaWorld assisted and put that animal back out in the wild. So either even, you know, from 93 until now or even before. So the only killer whale that I'm aware of that's ever been, you know, reintroduced back into the wild is Keiko, and we know that he, you know, did not survive in that situation. You know,
right, and well, Keiko's the whale from the movie Free Willy from back in 1993, and he was living in a very small pool in Mexico. It was really warm. He had a skin disease, and he was very underweight, and a huge amount of money was put into that project, and eventually ended up with him moving to the Oregon Aquarium, where they rehabbed him, and he gained a huge amount of weight, and then he was moved to Iceland, and he was further rehabbed there in an ocean pen, and eventually they started taking him out for what they called, like, ocean walks, and then finally he left on his own, and I believe he swam over 1,000 miles to Norway, and he was on his own for quite a bit of time, and he did interact with wild whales. So it's an interesting conversation, because the Keiko project by people who want to see some of the animals that are currently in captivity released is characterized as a success, because he got to go, I mean, this animal that was living in a tiny pool in Mexico got to go back out into the wild and interact with animals of his own kind. Now, on the other hand, and the animal display industry likes to characterize the Keiko situation as the worst case of animal abuse on record, is what they'll call it. So, I mean, because they, you know, and again, there's a vested interest in having it appear that way because they don't want anyone to think that their animals could be released. But I think there is a middle ground. And we all do you have any information on what's going on with the Morgan situation right now? The whale who was found very sick off Norway a couple of years ago?
Well, and going back to the Keiko thing real quick, important to note for all the listeners is that that was not a SeaWorld whale.
Right.
So the whole reintroduction process and trying to get him to survive on his own in the wild, that was not a SeaWorld directive. They weren't a part of that at all. As far as Morgan goes, I have not followed Morgan as closely as probably I should be following the Morgan situation. I know the basics of it, that they attempted to rehab her in Harderwijk, and then essentially then...
That's a Dolphinarium Harderwijk in Amsterdam, right?
And then there was an opportunity, obviously, there for SeaWorld to get their hand in the cookie jar, so to speak, and then next thing you know, she's at Laura Park in Spain, and, now the question mark is, who does she belong to? Who technically owns her at this point? And as far as moving her around, I think there would be so much criticism if they tried to bring her into the States to one of the SeaWorld parks. But I have no idea if that's their intention or their plan.
Right, so that's the one situation, the recent situation that we know of. We've got a sick killer whale that was brought to a dolphinarium in Amsterdam who has had a relationship in the past with SeaWorld. There have been some whales laundered through the dolphinarium Harderwijk in Amsterdam. Specifically, I'm thinking of Gudrun, a whale that I worked with back in the 90s. She was traded supposedly on a breeding loan from the dolphinarium Harderwijk to SeaWorld, and SeaWorld traded in return three false killer whales from Japan. So somehow they traded whales that they didn't own for an animal that was at a different park, and apparently SeaWorld was actually involved in her capture in the first place. And that story is detailed in the frontline show called A Whale of a Business, which you can find on the internet. But anyway, SeaWorld has had a relationship over the years with Dolphinarium Harderwijk, and so what happened in the case of Morgan, this recent whale who was found, that she was taken from the Dolphinarium Harderwijk and as you said, moved to Laurel Park, and now she's basically one of SeaWorld's whales and potentially is a breeding whale for them.
We've got so many great questions that have come in. I want to jump in here with Elizabeth Batt. She asks, with the emergence of Voice of the Orcas, and that's Vodo, what's the website for that?
It's a Google site, so if you just Google Voice of the Orcas, it'll come up.
Okay, with Voice of the Orcas, Death at SeaWorld, the book by David Kirby, which is going out on paperback really in a couple weeks.
David Kirby's book, Death at SeaWorld, will be released on July 2nd.
And then Blackfish coming up as a major film release here in July. So with all this happening, information on the inner workings of SeaWorld is being exposed like never before. How do you think this will affect future trainers and their relationship with their employers? Do you think they can or will implement confidentiality clauses, for example?
Absolutely. I'm sure they're kind of wishing they had handled things differently in the past at this point. And I think that important for trainers that are there, or even trainers that may want to get into the industry, hate to call it that when we're talking about this, but, I think there is a role for people whose heart is in the right place and they want to make a change in these whales' life, as long as these whales are still in captivity. And, we need to stop the breeding program, but the whales that are still in captivity now, what do you do with them? They still need caretakers. They still need people who, truly love those animals and want to provide the best care possible for them. So they're I think that people, what we did in the past, Sam, that now has shifted and there is a new role to play as long as they're still in captivity.
So moving into that, let's go ahead and have a discussion about the breeding program, because I think this is really fascinating about what's actually going on and how does SeaWorld run their breeding program. It's been, in the past, when SeaWorld first started, SeaWorld had to go out and collect killer whales from the wild. And in the movie Blackfish that's going to be coming out on July 19th, you'll actually be able to see footage of what it looks like when killer whales are captured and when they take babies from their moms. It's pretty horrific, and it's a pretty awful scene, and SeaWorld was actually kicked out of Washington State for doing that, and then very quickly moved to Iceland and started capturing whales, and eventually the practice was so shunned that SeaWorld started implementing a captive breeding program. And SeaWorld presents the captive breeding program as though it's part of their scientific research initiative and that they're doing something good to perpetuate the population. And I think the public, when they come to SeaWorld and they're told that most of the animals that they're seeing have been bred in captivity, that they can somehow feel good about that because they feel like, oh, well, these animals were not captured in the wild. But you, because you participated in the breeding program and helped implement the breeding program, and you've been there throughout the years while it's been going on, you have a very different perspective on it. So I would love for our listeners to get your perspective and to hear what you think about SeaWorld's captive breeding program, and then we'll talk a little bit about the specifics, how they even go about breeding killer whales in captivity.
Well, you know, it started back in 2000. So when this makes me think of our Q&A, Sam, in Miami, which we might have a good last thought here in a minute.
Yep, but, we will.
You know, we the team of us that did the insemination process on Kasaka, that was the first successful one anywhere in the world on a killer whale. Now, she gave birth to that whale, Nakai, in September of 2001.
And let me just interrupt real quick, because we're talking about, we want to make the distinction between the captive breeding program, which is letting the whales breed naturally, which the first baby Shamu was born, what was, is it 87? Or is it 85?
85.
So Kalina, who's Katina and Winston's daughter, was the first captive-bred killer whale who survived. And she actually only lived to 25 years old. She did die a couple years ago. But she is the first captive-bred orca who survived in captivity, but she was bred naturally. She wasn't, that animal was not bred using artificial insemination. So what we're talking about right now, and when you say the breeding program that started in 2000, this is an artificial insemination program where sperm is extracted from a male killer whale and then inserted into a female killer whale, and so it's a completely artificial process.
Absolutely. And even going back to, you know, the natural way, the natural process, I mean, when Kalina was born in 1985, you know, in the wild, females will get pregnant at 13 years of age or older, and you won't see them have a calf more frequently than every 3 years. When Kalina was born in 85, by the time she was 6 years old, she was pregnant with Keith, who was born at the Texas Park in 93. So you can see such a drastic difference even right there in the age that killer whales are becoming pregnant in a captive environment. And just jumping forward here to Kohana, who was the second AI calf that was born in 2002.
AI being artificial insemination. Just go ahead.
And when she was when she was moved to Spain, by the time she was 10 years old, she had given birth and rejected two of her calves. So beginning at the age of eight, she had her first calf, Adon. She rejected him. And then by 10, she had given birth to a second calf and rejected him. And also important to note, she had no mother in her environment, so she'd been stripped away from Takara when she was moved to Spain. And in Spain, she had no adult female to learn parenting skills from, or even help her or assist her. So it's not hard to see why that rejection happened. That would be very similar to a very young girl that gave birth to a child and had no parental supervision or anyone to help her or learn from. So, you know, we see that in society where most of the times that they abandon that child. So it's so horrific to think about Kohana in that situation and rejecting both of her calves. So, you know, what we're seeing in captivity is even the natural way, these whales are getting pregnant way earlier than they would in the wild, and they're getting pregnant much more frequently. And then now with the artificial insemination process beginning in the year 2000 with Kasaka, now we are forcing that on the whales. And since Don has been killed, it has been a huge priority, maybe the number one priority of senior management, to get the viable females in our corporation pregnant as fast as we can, and also the fastest turnaround that we can. So when a killer whale gives birth to a calf, normally they won't even cycle again until approximately a year and a half after they give birth. And a lot of factors influence that because, you know, they're nursing their calf, et cetera. So like with Takara, for example, when she gave birth to Sakari, we re-inseminated her again right when she started cycling again a year and a half later. So it was actually her second cycle. And the only reason why it wasn't the first cycle is we used the first cycle to really gauge that she was cycling again finally and that it was a normal cycle. And then we could prepare, you know, for the next go-around because they will cycle roughly every 40 days. So that way it gave us time to get everything in preparation for it. And so by that second cycle, she was inseminated again, AI. And then by that March of 2012, her progesterone levels had dropped off to the point. We don't know what happened, but by her progesterone levels, we knew that she could no longer sustain the pregnancy, so she lost it somehow. And by June, just a few months later, she had been inseminated again.
So they're really using these whales as they're like baby making machines, you know, and compared to the periodicity in the wild, you know, they'd have years in between. They'd be older when they got pregnant to start out with, but then they would have some number of years between calves. And so now these animals are literally being forced to have babies the soonest as they possibly can after they start their next cycle after having their last calf. So that you can imagine what that probably does to their health, right?
Yeah, and what I want people to really know about it is this is not like a litter of kittens that happens, you know, in such a very short period of time. Gestation for killer whales is over 17 months. So this killer whale is carrying this calf for over 17 months. When you see how uncomfortable they are, and for all the mothers out there, I can only imagine, you know, you have probably a pretty good idea of what I'm trying to refer to here. But, you know, when they're carrying, when you see how uncomfortable they are towards the end of that pregnancy, and then once they give birth, when you see especially the really good mothers like Kasaka and Takara, and you see them, you know, nursing their young for a year and a half to 2 years, teaching that calf everything, never leaving that calf side, being so concerned about that calf and protecting that calf, to think that they are just forcing this process on them. And we've lost whales in a corporation during the pregnancy process. Taima, she died in Florida when she was actually in the birthing process. So we have lost killer whales. So when you know that there's a risk of even losing that animal, and just all, like you're bringing up, all the health concerns too, it makes it even more horrific when you think of like really what they're forcing on these animals.
Yeah, Taima is a particularly sad case. Both of her parents actually were Gudrun, the whale I mentioned before, who came from the Dolphinarium Hardwick, and a whale named Canduke. Gudrun was actually a resident whale, and Canduke was a transient killer whale. And they're actually whales that would, you know, haven't interacted in the wild or bred together literally for over a million years. And so she was a true hybrid, first of all. And the even more tragic thing is the way Taima died, she actually had to have her calf, who was stillborn, winched out of her uterus, and she died during that process, which was probably horrifically painful. And the sad thing is her mom, Gudrun, actually died a very similar death. Both of those animals died from a very similar kind of death during trying to get a stillborn animal out of them. So we've just got about another few seconds before we need to take a break, and then I want to go into a little bit more of your description about the captive breeding program.
And on that note, I just wanted to bring Bridget Pirtle. She is a former coworker of yours, right, John?
Yeah,
she just chimed in on Facebook, and she just said, don't forget on the SeaWorld website, SeaWorld's mission statement, to entertain, amaze, and educate, and creating memories that last a lifetime. She points out entertainment is still a priority, period. So, you know, we just can't forget that there's a motive there that is to make money, absolutely.
So we're going to take a short break here. You're listening to Bridge to Everywhere, and we're interviewing former orca trainer John Hargrove. We'll be right back.
You are listening to KVRF, Radio Free Palmer. We are listener and member supported. You can make a difference. Join today at radiofreepalmer.org. Big Cabbage Radio.
And we're interviewing former SeaWorld trainer John Hargrove. And we were just talking about SeaWorld's captive breeding program. So one of the things when we've been talking about how things work, I want to get into the actual specifics of how the artificial insemination process works. And one of the ways John has described this as kind of like an alien abduction. So the sorts of things that we do to these whales to get them pregnant, to collect semen, to impregnate the females, is the kind of things that we imagine would happen if we were suddenly whisked off the surface of the planet by an alien ship and experimented on. So I want to hear you talk about, you know, what is actually the process for collecting sperm from the male killer whales, and then how you go about inseminating the females, and what that's probably like for the animals.
And what is the genetic lineage of the who's donating the sperm, which whales, and is that well thought out?
At this point, especially, it's very well thought out. I mean, before you're wanting a viable whale. And like, for example, we had trained that process on Ulysses out in California, but he wasn't viable. Now they have an agreement with France, and he actually is the father of a calf in France. She was born in 2011. I believe is when that calf was born. So other than that calf, which is an artificial insemination from Ulysses' sperm, Ulysses has no other calves in the corporation. And again, this calf is in France, so it's outside the corporation, but clearly they have some type of an agreement, if you will. But so far, the sperm that we have used is almost all tillicum. And then now we're using Chimik. So Chimik was used to. Chimik is in Argentina. He's a solitary killer whale in Argentina, and obviously they have an arrangement now there as well. So this also goes to show people how even though SeaWorld has almost all the killer whales in captivity in the world, even the ones that they don't have in captivity, they have a large say and a large presence for involving all killer whales in the world. So again, it just goes back to show you how powerful they are.
John, is there any conversation about using the sperm of a whale that's killed three people in the gene pool of all the breeding program? Does that ever come up as a concern in the discussions you've ever had?
It's never been discussed. Never. It's never been. No one has ever voiced a concern about that, brought that up, mentioned it in any way, shape, or form. And back to the alien abduction, when I actually made that comment, came to that kind of epiphany, was one day I was working a session and with another trainer, and we were working whales in the back pool in Texas, and we were laughing and joking around about stuff, having a good time with our whales, and I just thought of it. All of a sudden I was like, what we're doing is the equivalent of an alien abduction. And, we kind of had a laugh about it at the time, but, it's really, obviously it's a serious subject matter, but like you said, Sam, this is the stuff of our nightmares. If we were, when you envision that you're abducted from your home planet by an alien species, they poke you and prod you and inseminate you, and they do all these things to you and test you and all that. That's exactly what we've done to these animals. So the stuff of a horror movie.
And you've been, you've worked with Takara to train her on to actually do work, like be there while she's getting inseminated. So can you just talk about what that actually looks like? What is that like for the whale?
Yeah.
What do you have to do?
The key element for females when you're conditioning that is for them to tolerate it is, you know, you're looking for them to be very calm and relaxed in a ventral position. So obviously in a ventral position, their blowhole is under the water, so they're holding their breath. So we would work it where they would be, you know, hold their breath up to 10 minutes and be very calm, very still, very relaxed. Then they need to be comfortable to accept the tube that is inserted inside them, and also be comfortable with the air that we inject into the cervix to open up the cervix. So when we actually do the procedure, and like I said, the cycle is roughly every 40 days. Some females are pretty regular and have a normal cycle. So we have some females in the corporation that do not cycle normally. So, and there's a lot of health issues sometimes that are related to that. But so when we get the urines, we condition the whales to give us urine samples every day, twice a day on the females. And in that urine sample, we analyze for three different hormones, estrogen, progesterone, and luteinizing hormone. So when the combination of looking for those hormones in the urine every single day, and then once it gets time and we know there's a follicle, we'll sonogram the whales and we can monitor that follicle.
A follicle being an egg, just so people know.
Right, thank you. And people can think of it too as like when the follicle, it's like kind of think of like a water balloon. So once it gets filled so full with water, it'll burst. Now, when that sac bursts, the egg will drop down into the fallopian tube. So the goal is you have to have the sperm in that fallopian tube ready for when the egg drops or you've missed your opportunity to fertilize the egg. So what we have to do, and we've gotten it down to so precise terms where we can monitor within hours of when exactly that process is going to happen. So, and everything has to be so perfect with the sperm that's been frozen and now shipped across country and, you know, ready to go for that exact window of time. So, now when we do something like that, obviously you're going to have the most experienced trainers on that whale, and the trainers that have the best relationships. So for me personally, I wanted to be there with Takara because I felt like I was one of the people that could make that experience for her as comfortable as it could be. So for me, I was chosen to do it anyway, but I would have made sure that I did it because I wanted her to be comfortable. I was concerned about her, but yet at the same time, it's like you're doing something to her that you don't want. You don't want to happen to her. So when she lost that calf, and I say when she lost it, I mean her progesterone levels dropped off, so we don't really know for sure that she ever had it. We just know that her progesterone levels registered. There's no way she could have sustained a pregnancy, and she clearly was not pregnant anymore. But when that happened, I was happy because I didn't want her to be pregnant. And, you know, I had a direct conversation with a supervisor at Texas, and I said, you know, I'm glad that happened. I didn't want her to get pregnant. I didn't want her to go through all of that again. Now, the sad part of that is they only waited a few months, and then they did it again. And at that point, I had left. So,
when you had that conversation with management, I know that you mentioned to me that at first you were objecting to the breeding program, and then you were convinced to sort of see it another way, and that lasted for about 24 hours, and then you woke up and you said, "Wait a second." So, could you just tell our listeners about that?
And along with that, one of our listeners, Kay Jones, asks, "How hard was it for you to step away from the whales that you've worked with for so many years? Even though you strongly believe in this cause, do you still check in on them, how they're doing, even though you're no longer working at SeaWorld?"
Man, that's a good question. I mean, leaving SeaWorld, all components and aspects of me leaving SeaWorld, I was okay with. And even leaving some of the whales, I mean, I loved and I missed them, but it's still hard for me to come to terms with leaving Takara behind. And when I first left, there were some trainers that are still at Shamu Stadium, and they would send me pictures and video clips of Takara. And I know that they were well-intentioned, but I couldn't bring myself to look at those pictures of her and those video clips of her. And I would send them, I would say, "Thank you, but please don't send that to me. I don't want to see her. Now, I can look at all the pictures that I have of me and Takara throughout the years and in the water and all that, but it's different looking at those pictures that I know have already happened. For me, the struggle is looking at anything new of her, you know, any new pictures of her, new video of her. So that's something that I still haven't really come completely to terms with. And when the subject of Takara comes about, especially like in a private one-on-one conversation with somebody, I'll really kind of just push that off to the side. Anything else about leaving SeaWorld, I'm okay with, I've come to terms with. But leaving her behind, I feel like right now, I don't know if I'll ever completely come to terms with that, because that's how special she was to me and how much she meant to me. But you know, going back to my direct conversation with management, Sam, and this just goes to show you how good the spin machine is, because, you know, I consider myself to be very strong-willed about my opinions about these whales and what has happened in the past, the good and the bad. And I remember, you know, I was pissed off and vocal at work, and everybody knew it, about how I didn't agree with her being artificially inseminated. I didn't want her to go through this. She was just being treated as a baby machine and blah, 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 all this stuff. And I was pulled aside by a supervisor that I had a lot of respect for. And she told me, she's like, John, you are a leader of this area, and I cannot have you get the other trainers on this team upset and pissed off about this situation. Like, this is what's happening. You have to accept it. And even if you don't accept it, you got to portray that you accept it to the team, because you're a leader in this area. But what she said to me next, you know, and Sam, I've talked about this a lot. She said to me, she said, we have a moral responsibility to diversify their gene pool. And us doing this to these whales is for the benefit of these animals. And the way she said it and the way she spun it, I stopped in my tracks and I said to her, thank you so much for explaining it to me that way. That takes away a lot of my anger that I have about this issue, and I've never had anyone explain it to me that way. And it wasn't until like 24 to 48 hours later, and I just realized, like, what the hell just happened? Like, I snapped out of it. It was like someone had put something in my Kool-Aid, and I drank it, and I truly believed it at first for like, you know, a day or two before I came back to my senses. And it just goes to show you, like, if that can happen to me with my experience level and everything that I know, of course the public is easily persuaded.
It shows you, it absolutely shows you how powerful the spin machine is, and why, you know, a lot of the questions we get are, you know, well, what about the people who are still working there, and why don't they see this? You know, and some of it is because I think they don't want to see it because they want to keep doing their job. But there's also this, I mean, that when you hear it day in and day out, I mean, I believed what I was told by management, because, you know, and at the time back when I started, it was 1990 and there was no internet. So I couldn't, you know, I probably could have gone to the library and looked up to some of this stuff. But, you know, there, I didn't really have any reason not to trust it. And it was only, you know, years later when I was able to think it through. And so in the moment like that, it's really easy to see, well, okay, that makes sense. I can go along with that. And then, you know, the fact that it only took you 48 hours to think, whoa, wait a second, that's crazy, is good. Some people, it takes a lot longer for them to wake up.
Well, it's a really hard thing to do, because you're there for the right reasons in your mind, and you love the animal so much that, you know, you're to really come to terms and take the wisdom from your heart over what's being fed to you from the corporation to keep you in the status quo. It's just a huge leap.
Well, and what was so persuasive about it to me is that this was coming from somebody who I respected and who I knew loved these whales as much as I did, and really wanted the best life for them. But, you know, she's a victim of the spin machine as well. So, you know, I listened to her because I really truly respected what she had to say, and I knew she was coming at it from the right direction. But, you know, we jokingly say, you know, that the, you know, drinking the Kool-Aid and all that, and it's really true. It's like almost like a Jim Jones effect for animal training or for the captive industry. I mean, I think it preys on people whose heart is in the right place, that love these animals, and this is their passion, but you just kind of get misguided with it, and then things are spun, and then you just kind of lose almost a reality on it sometimes, because especially because it's such a closed off society, and
yeah,
you want to believe.
Absolutely. And it's a, you know, ultimately, of course, this is an entertainment business, and it is exploitation of animals. And like you said, the people who are making the money off of the animals are sort of preying on the people who work for them, who have more altruistic values. And so you can see how things get easily twisted. And actually, that is a good segue into what's going on right now with OSHA, because the Occupational Safety and Health Administration just re-cited SeaWorld for a serious violation. They basically recited them with the original violation that was cited when Don was killed by Tillicum. So I want to move into the OSHA violations, because this actually speaks directly to OSHA is coming in and trying to protect the trainers. And in some
That's
cases,
right.
the trainers don't want to be protected. So it's an interesting
right.
conversation, because OSHA is saying that SeaWorld knew that in the particular case of Don and Tillicum, that Tillicum was a dangerous animal, and that SeaWorld allowed their trainers to get in dangerous proximity with Tillicum and other whales. There are many other accidents that you can go on the internet and Google and find lists of accidents that were reported, and there's many other accidents that weren't. So I want to get into the OSHA case, but and I'll start out with a question from a woman named Aubrey Kane, Aubrey Kane, K-E-H-N, and she says, my question for Mr. Hargrove is this. Do you believe that the restrictions OSHA has placed on water work and other close contact are helpful or harmful to the whales at SeaWorld, and why?
Wow, what a great question. And this whole OSHA situation, man, it is, it really makes you think. And I have had to really do some soul searching about how I feel about this issue, because as a trainer, I want the most for these whales. I want these animals to have more in their life. I don't want to take stuff away from them. So, as you know, the whales, and Sam, you and I and the other trainers in the film, we've had this debate even recently. How much do we feel these whales are truly losing if you take the water work out, if you take the close contact out? I am one who personally believes that the water work is the biggest part of those whales' life, and no doubt the whales' life has shrank by taking the water work out. And also, if you take two trainers that both have 5 years or both have 10 years of experience, and they both work the whales the same amount of time, but one swims with that whale and one doesn't, the trainer that swims with that whale is going to have a much stronger relationship, because there is a level of intimacy with the water work that you cannot achieve just by working them dry. But what I've had to come to terms with and face the reality of, and trust me, this was not an overnight thing for me. I really had to, like I said, do some soul searching. That is not OSHA's job. OSHA was not designed or formed to make sure the whales have the most enriching life or have the highest level of intimacy with their trainers. OSHA was formed to ensure the safety and health of employees, to enforce workplace safety. You know, specifically, the Occupational Safety and Health Act says, it states that the duty to comply rests with the employer. An employer cannot shift responsibility to its employee to determine unsafe working conditions. And when you look at any of our aggressive incidents with these whales, that is precisely what SeaWorld management has done historically, is shift that blame back onto the trainers. This is the whole reason why OSHA exists, is to regulate companies, to regulate corporations, so that they do not put their employees in unsafe working conditions. So, you know, I think SeaWorld would love for trainers to just think of OSHA as this evil entity whose sole purpose is to strip water work away from those whales and strip water work away from those trainers. But, you know, there are probably people in OSHA that have worked on this case that probably love killer whales, that want the best life possible, for killer whales and would love to give them more, but that's not their job. Their job is to protect us and to make sure corporations are not putting us in those unsafe positions. So in that regard, OSHA has done their job. As painful, as hard as it is for me, because I don't want to take anything away from those whales, that's the reality of it.
Yeah, it's a workplace safety issue. If you actually look at the fact that SeaWorld trainers are not contract employees, they're hourly employees. And so the employer, SeaWorld, does have an obligation to keep their worker safe. And so I agree, you know, it's not different than OSHA coming into an unsafe construction site or any kind of unsafe workplace and saying, hey, there's violations here. I think the difference in this particular case and why it's actually catalyzing so much animosity from both sides of the fence is that it really, because this issue is being brought to the forefront, it is actually forcing people to have to look at the moral issue of whether or not it's right to keep these large intelligent animals that have these social structures that are so complicated. They swim over 100 miles a day. There's no way we can meet their needs in captivity, and it's basically forced this issue into the public right now. But of course, that's not what the OSHA case is about. And so we really, I think it's good to make that separation, that the OSHA case is purely about the safety issue and whether or not SeaWorld was at fault for allowing a trainer to get in close proximity, especially with a whale that had already been responsible for the death of two people in the past. So that's really what this is about. But what we're moving into now, because the OSHA case has got so much publicity, it's actually getting this conversation into the public about the bigger conversation of, is it morally right just because we can, should we be keeping these animals in captivity?
Yeah, and I want to join in. Questions from listeners.
Sure.
Patty Anderson asks, how does OSHA arrive at the amount of the fine? If SeaWorld is violating the restrictions, why don't the fines fit the punishment? Don's life or any other employee's life is worth more than any past or previous amount. And that brings up the question of, what happens if there's another death? Any thoughts about that, if that does happen? Russell Hawkins joined in. He says, what if the company puts the public at risk due to their actions? So not just employees at risk, but the public, and asks if that's regulated by OSHA. And he's referring to the placement of workers in a public access petting pool by SeaWorld San Diego in 1980.
Well, gosh, so many things have changed since the 80s. I mean, when you look back at these pictures of things that we did with the park guests, I mean, Sam, there's a clip of you in the film, and you're doing a kid set. I think we eliminated that.
The kid set, for people who don't know, is where I was actually, I picked up a kid from the audience and put the kid on the killer whale's back to pose for a picture while there was a senior trainer holding the orca at on a slide-out area. We used to do that.
Yeah, and so even before Don and Alexis were killed, there's a reason why we stopped doing that. I mean, we learned enough that we're like, oh, maybe this isn't so safe to do after all. So when you look at the years that went by and the decades and stuff, we kept learning things, and slowly but surely we would say, yeah, that's not such a great idea. That's another reason why it was so disheartening to see the recent photo that just got posted of The Rock, the actor and wrestler, and he's at Miami Sea Aquarium, and he's got a full-on hand target on Lolita and kissing her rostrum. It's like, I know he knows what's happened with Don. So, I mean, even if you're at a place that says, oh, yeah, you can do it, you should be educated enough to know that you shouldn't do that, even just for your own safety.
And it's a hard thing to see celebrities doing that, because it appears that they're endorsing it, and then all the kids that are fans of the particular celebrity are going to think that's an okay to do. So okay thing to do. So I think it's really important when we see those kinds of things. I know I've seen a lot of tweets today on Twitter and a lot of posts on Facebook specifically to The Rock saying, hey, this was not right, and you should make a public apology, and you should go watch the movie Blackfish, and you should read David Kirby's book Death at SeaWorld, and watch the movie A Fall from Freedom and Frontlines a Whale, the business, and educate yourself and know that this is not, that you should not be doing this.
Well, and going back to what we were talking just a second ago, as a trainer, we are willing to put ourselves in that position of risk with those animals because that was our passion. That's what we wanted to do. It is a completely different story when a corporation, a company, places their employee in a position of harm for profit. So, you know, you can see where there's the exploitation that happens in that scenario. And again, that goes back to OSHA that, you know, is there to protect employees and to regulate. I can't help but think, like, look at the way that they've handled Don being killed. Imagine if there was no regulation. Imagine if there was no regulation at all, the stuff that SeaWorld would attempt to get away with. Because with Don being killed, we know that they blamed her. I can tell you from my personal experience, senior management blamed her at the Texas park. And we saw the way that their expert witness testified in the OSHA hearings. And also then, you know, SeaWorld itself saying that they were unaware that we had dangerous jobs, essentially. I'm paraphrasing it. But, of course, they were aware we had dangerous jobs. So if you have this company that's not even willing to acknowledge that you have a dangerous job when something horrific happens, and this is with being regulated by OSHA, imagine if there was no regulation.
Exactly. So I mean, they're playing an important role. And I want to get to, I've got another question here. Hi, Sam and Kevin. First off, I just want to thank you both for the wonderful interview with John Hargrove. It was incredibly insightful and fascinating. A huge thank you also to John for coming forward, standing up to SeaWorld, and bringing public attention to the issue of cetacean captivity. I did have a question I've been curious about for a while, and I'm wondering if John, with his insider knowledge, can address it. After Don was killed, SeaWorld Orlando completely stripped out the rocks and natural features out of G-Pool and installed a fast-rising floor, which they claim can be brought up in as little as 60 seconds. I know the whales are used to being lifted out of the water in the med pool, however, that only measures 8 feet deep and moves fairly slow. My question is, has SeaWorld tested the fast rising floor with an orca in the tank? And if so, what was the whale's reaction to the speed and commotion? Thanks again for the wonderful interview. Eagerly looking forward to part two.
By the time that I left, the floor was not tested with killer whales. So the floor had been tested, obviously. And by the time I had left in August 2012, that floor was just recently operational at the Florida Park in the Dynamo Shamu Pool. But no whales have been on that lifting floor with it being raised. Because even when they first put that floor in and trying to iron out the kinks in it, in the beginning, the floor would fail and only like part of it would rise up and it would have this like very dangerous slope. So then they had to go back to the drawing board and they had to fix it. So I don't know even if now that floor has been tested with whales on it. But, you know, in both Dawn's case, you know, her death and also Alexis's death, a fast rising floor that rises in 50 seconds would not have saved either one of them. So that's what's important to take away from that. Like that might be something that's new and something that, you know, we've never had before as a tool to help us, but it would not have, you know, saved Don or Alexis.
It's a good point, considering the damage that was done to both Don and Alexis, that, you know, that particular abatement that SeaWorld was trying to put in place wouldn't have saved either one of them. So the question is, when the next accident happens, even if there is a fast-rising floor, is there potential that could save a trainer, or do you think that would likely potentially cause more damage?
Well, I can tell you from being in water work aggressions myself, you know, it is a very delicate situation when you're in the water with an animal like that and they become upset and aggression starts. There is a window of opportunity to turn that animal around. If you miss that opportunity or if you make the wrong choice, that window closes and the aggression accelerates and intensifies. So I can tell you, if I was in an aggression and I'm hoping that at some point I'm going to be able to behaviorally work through that and redirect that animal and turn that animal around and get them to calm down and get positive stuff out of them and get out of there safely. The worst thing in the world is like some huge environmental change, because what do you think is going to happen? All your work at trying to redirect that animal and turn them around is going to be flushed down the toilet, and it's just going to hit that animal
so,
off.
So, hey, John, we're actually going to have to stop
last
you
10
there
seconds
because
we've
got the last 10
yeah, last
seconds
10
of the show, so
hey,
we'll hold it there.
We want to thank everybody for your great questions. And, John, thanks for being on our show. How can people follow up with you? Are you on Twitter, and what can they do to make a difference in 2 seconds?
The The great way to go is Voto site, Voice of the Orca site, and I'm at John J. Hargrove on Twitter.
All right. Thank you for joining us, John Hargrove, former SeaWorld trainer. You're listening to Bridge to Everywhere. Have a wonderful evening, everybody, and we will see you next week. Have a great night.
Thank you.
Thanks, Sam. Thanks, Kevin.
All right. Bye-bye.
Thank you for joining us on the Bridge to Everywhere, broadcasting on KVRF 89.5 Big Cabbage Radio in Palmer, Alaska. Like us on Facebook at Bridge to Everywhere to access more information, links and resources from our guests and show topics.